I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Metropolitan Orlando ranks number one among the nation's mid-sized cities in chronic homelessness, according to a recent report prepared for Congress. I'll speak with the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida's president and CEO Brent Trotter and former chair and now volunteer for the Coalition Brian Wilson about initiatives to reduce chronic homelessness in the area. Also, 90.7's Amy Kiley joins us in the studio to discuss a case currently being decided by the Florida Supreme Court on the regulation of the state's utility companies. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by Brent Trotter, President and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. Brent, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
Also joined by Brian Wilson. Brian is a former chair of the board and now volunteer at the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. Brian, thank you very much for coming in.
Good to be here.
Well, in the recent homeless census prepared for Congress, Metro Orlando ranks number one among the nation's mid-sized cities in the number of chronically homeless, up from a fifth last year. Brent, this is not really something you want the city of Orlando to be number one in.
Well, certainly don't want to be number one in the issue of homelessness, period. But the reality is, as a community grows, we're going to begin to see more and more people experience that crisis. And then, of course, it's not just the chronic homelessness. We're seeing a good number of families who are experiencing that crisis as well.
Has homelessness always been an issue in Central Florida, and now we're just starting to take better stock of it?
I think homelessness is a part of any community that is growing and experiencing the rapid growth that Central Florida as a region has experienced. And so I think that we, as you say, taken stock of it. We've known about this for years. The Coalition is in its 26th year of serving this community. And so it's not something that's a new idea that's come to the forefront. I mean, it's something we've been dealing with for years.
Well, Brian, as a former chair of the board for the Coalition of the Home for the Homeless in Central Florida, what sort of changes have you seen over your involvement with this issue?
Well, I think the thing that struck me the most when I got involved was that it was not really about just the single male that a lot of people, I think, associate with homelessness. And through the time that we've been involved in the Coalition, the reality is that we deal with families and children most of the time, and they tend to be the most compelling circumstances, and people just don't know about it.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Because, again, I think there's maybe a societal perception that the man on the street, the man sitting next to the building with his hand out, is really what homelessness is about. It certainly can be about that, and that's a serious issue that we have to deal with, but it really has to do with families that are in the downward spiral as well. And that's a very real reality that's been even compounded with, obviously, the economic collapse that we've seen over the last 4 years.
Do you think it's easier for folks who aren't homeless and don't experience that in their own lives to be sympathetic towards perhaps a family, a mother and children, rather than the single male that you talked about?
No question about it. And we certainly found that as we've, in terms of trying to reach out to the community to get their support, when people are educated about that, they do tend to respond. But at the same time, we've struggled with that a little bit because the single male has that need as well. And with the new Men's Service Center, we're really trying to focus on that and creating a system that will help the single male as well as the systems we have for families.
Mm-hmm. Brent Trotter, how do you define chronic homelessness? How is that different from just homelessness?
Well, it's an interesting question you ask, and it depends sometimes on how who you ask, because there are a number of different definitions out there that are really define homelessness, and they're government agencies that do that. But generally speaking, chronic homelessness is individuals who have been homeless without any kind of stable housing for over a year. So typically, as Brian just mentioned, it is the guy on the street who has been living on the streets for a year. Now, he may have stopped in and received what's referred to as emergency services. He may have a meal at a place that he can get a free meal. He may sleep in a shelter, or he may sleep out in the woods or something. But the chronically homeless are those who are homeless for over a year, and oftentimes they are experiencing some sort, some level of mental health issues, mental illness.
So what kind of people have find themselves chronically homeless? I mean, we talked a little bit about the more families perhaps popping up on the radar, but what other folks beside the single male are chronically homeless these days?
Well, that's the largest population of chronically homeless. There are certainly women who are chronically homeless. And one of the things that the services we provide, and this is kind of to a point that was made earlier, I think one of the reasons we don't see more women, children, and families on the street is because the Coalition for the Homeless provides those services. I mean, we had nearly 200 kids who were in our services just last night. So when you think about living on the street, the services we provide help to keep families off the street. And as Brian alluded just a moment ago, we're about to open a brand new facility that's going to be addressing the homeless male population specifically, and particularly it's going to be reaching out to those who are the chronically homeless, those who have been homeless for a long, long period of time.
How many people will it serve?
It'll serve 250 will be the capacity that we'll be able to serve. And of that 250, 50 of those beds will be dedicated to substance abuse recovery programs. We will have some job training. We'll have opportunities to have a specific veterans initiative to reach out to veterans, because nationally, stats tell us that somewhere between 1 in 4, 1 in 5 homeless males are a veteran of some service in our military.
This new facility opening, when's that going to come online?
You know, we're anticipating that it will be within the next 60 days. We don't have a real firm date yet, because we're still in the final stages of construction, but it's going to be a tremendous asset to the community to bring gentlemen in and expose them and give them access to services that many of them have never had access to before.
And is it replacing something that's out there already that's become too old, or is it completely new?
Well, the facility is completely new. The services will be completely new. As far as a replacement, what we currently are doing is simply providing a hot meal, a safe place to sleep, and then early in the morning, the men are dismissed to go right back out on the streets. And that's the seismic shift that's going to be taking place, is that they will be able to live there as a resident, and services will be delivered to them, if that's a good term. They'll be able to stay there. They'll be able to go to school. They'll have access to mental health services, to health care services. If they have a substance abuse or alcohol problem, they can be enrolled in a recovery program. And if they're a veteran, we'll be working closely with other agencies to ensure that those veterans have access to the services that they deserve.
There's another report we did some work on, we did some reporting on rather, just recently, that says that Floridians are the most cost-burdened in the nation when it comes to housing. In terms of rent, a lot of them spend more than a third of their income on housing costs. What kind of impact does this have on homelessness?
Well, it's a real issue, and I served on the original commission, regional commission, and one of the problems that we focused on was we certainly have a lot of providers that are kind of deal with that emergent stage of homelessness, and even the development of transitional living alternatives is something that people have been focusing on. But if we don't have affordable housing at the end of that process, we're not going to ultimately solve the problem. And I know Brent's much more familiar with kind of the real economic realities of that as we try to help these people transition into that final residence.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brent, let me ask you, I mean, is there kind of a gray area when you talk about high rent and people maybe just sort of being pushed off that cliff there?
Well, there is, and affordable housing is sort of the operative word. When you've got very little affordable housing, the question is, where do people who can't afford housing go? That's the question of the hour in many cases. And so when you've got low wages and you've got high rents, the clear alternative is that there is no alternative, and that homelessness is certainly going to be in the future of someone who's trying to carve out an existence in that kind of situation.
I'm talking to Brent Trotter. He's the president and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. Also joined by Brian Wilson, the former chair of the board of the Coalition for the Homeless in Central Florida. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7. I'm Matthew Petty. You can join the conversation online on Facebook and Twitter. You can also send us an email, intersection@wmfe.org. Well, Brent, let me ask you too. I mean, I know there are initiatives in place to provide affordable housing. For example, in Osceola County, they recently opened Victory Village, which I gather is run by an organization that also serves veterans, transforming an old motel in that area of Kissimmee into some affordable housing units. Is this the way to go? Are other counties looking at similar things?
Well, I think there's going to have to be an approach that is open to all opportunities that are there. I think that that certainly is an approach that they've looked at and says it works there. I'm a big believer that many of the solutions for homelessness lie at the local level. I don't think that we need to look to Washington for all of the answers about homelessness. What works in one metropolitan area may not work in another because there's just different ways of doing things. I view Central Florida more of the young adolescent community versus the New York City that might be into young adulthood or Chicago or some of the big major cities of this country. And so Central Florida has lagged behind in being able to address this issue because we've grown faster as a community, and now what follows is the issue of people who fall through the cracks, through the safety nets of the homeless, and become homeless, and we don't have that safety net fully knit together yet, and so it's an option. We're not as established as a New York or a Chicago or those older communities, so they've got an infrastructure that's there. Central Florida doesn't have that infrastructure for the needs that we have. I mean, we have emergency shelters, we have some transitional, but we don't have near enough. We don't have affordable housing, we don't have permanent supportive housing, which is a slice of part of the solution to be able to provide supportive services to those who have a severe mental illness. Particularly, they are going to, if they don't have that permanent supportive housing arrangement where services can be delivered to them, then they are destined to be right back out on the street. So we've got to have a mix of all of these kinds of things in order to have a permanent solution to the issue of homelessness in our communities.
Well, Brian, if I could just segue to you for a moment. I mean, talking about, you know, definitions of homelessness, we actually had Christina Savino from Orange County Public Schools talking about homeless students. I'm wondering, do you think, given that high number of homeless students, is that a good barometer of homelessness in general in the county?
I think it's probably a fair barometer, and that kind of goes to the issue that I think we've struggled for a long time, which is to help educate and kind of change the understanding of what the definition of homelessness is. I do know we've had some high, some publicity from some national media outlets that focused particularly on the problems here in Central Florida. The response to that was extraordinary. So I think there have been some steps made to help educate people on what real homelessness is. One other thing the message that we have to get out, though, is that our efforts are not to end all homelessness, because the reality is that can't be done. But the reality is also that most homelessness can be solved, and we don't have to invent new methods for doing that. The answers are there. Case management, which is what we're so excited about that we're bringing to the Men's Service Center, case management works. If you have a system, you understand what these people are dealing with, and you get their commitment to a process, you can see very favorable results. And I think if we get that message out as well, we can get more people to embrace the idea of assisting.
Mm-hmm. There's also been a bit of a debate going on now about whether or not to increase the minimum wage. I'm wondering if you think that would have an impact on homelessness one way or the other if there was an increase to the minimum wage. Brent Trotter, what are your thoughts? Do you think that there could be some kind of flow-on effect?
You know, usually minimum wage is so minimal in its increase that even if it was raised, it probably wouldn't have an immediate impact on the issue of homelessness. I think the real discussion needs to be about living wage, and living wage needs to fall in line with skill acquisition. I mean, opportunities for people who have not had opportunities to acquire a skill, a marketable skill, so then go to the marketplace and apply that skill. One of the things that we do, and one of the great partners we have on our own campus, is Orange County Public Schools, not just for our children. Our children go to local schools that we're zoned for, but our adults have access to adult education opportunities, over 100 opportunities are available right there on our campus in the classroom with Orange County Public School staff there to help give them guidance in that. So a person can acquire a skill, whether it be a welder or a mechanic or an air conditioning tech or those kinds of skills. Then they can get out and they can break that barrier of that minimum wage if that's been their crisis and that's led to their crisis. That certainly is part of that. So, you know, I hear a lot of discussion about minimum wage, but unfortunately, oftentimes the minimum wage is so small in its incremental increases that I'm not sure that that's going to make an immediate impact on somebody's ability to turn around a homeless situation.
Brian, finally, I wonder if you would just weigh in here. I mean, you volunteer your time to the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. What are some things, some practical things that people can do if they want to help the organization?
There's a lot to do. In fact, fully, I would say about 25% of the value, the support that we get in running the coalition each year is volunteer help. We've got a volunteer coordinator. The easiest thing to do is just come help serve a meal.
Do you get an increase in people volunteering around this time of year?
I don't know, Brent, do we?
Yeah, we actually do. I mean, it's the holiday season. It's the giving back, you know, from the early days before Thanksgiving until all the way through the Christmas holiday season. We do have people because people's attention turn to the giving back.
Giving Tuesday, right? Is that starting
right
to take off here?
Yeah, well, it has. Absolutely, it has. We benefited from that. We had a little online giving opportunity for that as well. So it does get the attention, and people do set back, and they think, gosh, you know, we've got so much. I've had three conversations today, coincidentally, who was talking about Christmas. They, you know, I don't need anything. There's nothing I really need. And so we've had some folks who say, you know what, instead of giving family, we're going to give to somebody else, somebody who otherwise would not have Christmas. And we benefit from that. But yes, and then I guess the word I would give to your listeners would be that while this holiday season, you know, giving and volunteering and giving back may be the forethought, I would say, hey, think about this in June, July, and August. Those are the times when we are in need of volunteers, and we have opportunities for people to serve. We have projects they can engage in as a volunteer. And, you know, I don't think it would be fair for anybody to expect me to say all of that without saying, you know, financial support is critical to our work, too. So anyone who wants to give to us financially can help us as well.
I've been speaking to Brent Trotter, President and CEO for the Coalition for the Homeless of Central Florida. Brent, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
We've also been joined by Brian Wilson. Brian is the former chair of the board and now volunteer at the Coalition for the Homeless. Brian, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, I'll speak with 90.7's Amy Kiley about the Florida Supreme Court case involving the state's utility regulators. Today on Intersection, we're talking about how Central Florida is trying to help the homeless, but some people who have homes can't afford to cool or heat them. Heating can be a concern even in Florida, where some winter nights can dip below freezing, and this is one of only two states that have no special protection for disconnection of utilities at certain times of year. Well, 90.7's Amy Kiley set out to find out why, and she encountered a tangle of politics, regulation, and business interests. She also found the issue is reaching ahead in an ongoing state Supreme Court case, and she joins us on Intersection now to help us sort through some of these Florida utilities issues. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how well does Florida regulate utilities?
It depends on whom you ask. A Tampa Bay Times editorial says, quote, "The likelihood of Florida electric customers getting a fair shake when utility companies seek a rate increase is about as low as seeing a Florida panther, and the odds may soon get worse." So state regulators obviously disagree with that. The Public Service Commission reviews rate increases, and in its stated mission, it says it tries to facilitate utility services at fair prices, with the goal being unbiased. I talked to the general counsel of that organization, S. Curtis Kaiser, and here's what he has to say about the commission's aims.
Well, first of almost all the states have the same setup. Virtually every state has anywhere from a 3 to 5 or more membered public service commission. The commission has to balance just like a court, they have to balance the interests of the consumer and the interests of the company.
And the editorial you just mentioned now in the Tampa Bay Times said the and the mission statement of the Public Service Commission are quite different. Why is that?
Critics say follow the money. The five members of the Public Service Commission are gubernatorial appointees. The idea is they are separate from political and financial interests because the Public Service Commission nominating council sends names as suggestions to the governor. Now, that council is comprised of six lawmakers and six members of the general public. But critics say that is too close to politics because the president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House appoint that nominating council. The governor appoints the commissioners and lawmakers approve them. So people say a lot of politicians are involved and utilities give money to politicians for their campaigns. FollowTheMoney.org shows in 2012 alone, utilities gave the state's political parties about $2.4 million. So multiply that number by parent companies lobbying nationally multiple years, different states, and we're talking just millions of dollars. Joe and Jane, lightbulb user, can't dole out millions to lobby to keep their electric bills low. So critics say that gives utilities a lot of power when they propose rate increases.
Even though there is a seat at the table for some members of the public, you said six members of the public get to sit on that table?
Through a string, the nominating committee that appoints them is appointed by lawmakers, and the governor is actually doing the appointees. So how separate from politicians are they really is what some people are asking.
And I guess the counter-argument is that politicians do vote against lobbyist interests sometimes. I mean, does the Public Service Commission blindly approve every utility rate request?
Of course not. But in 2010, the Senate failed to confirm two commissioners whom the governor had appointed. Some people say that was because they opposed utility interests. The same year, the Public Service Commission nominating council effectively ousted the PSC chair, Nancy Argaziano, and one of her commissioners, Nathan Scopp. Supporters of the move claim sour grapes, saying the nominating committee was just doing its job. But the chair said in an interview with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the money of utilities had spoken loudly in the matter. And Scott said, quote, if you do your job and ask the right questions, you lose your job. If the money and influence aren't apparent to people, they're asleep at the wheel. And of course, supporters of the change up on that commission say lawmakers were justified. They were just looking for qualified applicants. They wanted to balance the interests of the utility companies and consumers. They argue the rate increases the commission has approved have been justified.
So, Amy, the editorial you mentioned at the start of our conversation suggested that Florida electric consumers don't really have much of a chance when it comes to big utilities asking for a rate hike.
Yeah, and it also said that things could get worse. And the reason it said that is that the issue is currently before the state Supreme Court, and that case involves another player, the Office of Public Counsel. So think of the Public Service Commission like a court. The commissioners are the jury, the utilities are on the one side, and the Office of Public Counsel is on the other side representing consumers. It often fights for lower utility bills. In 2012, which is right after that shakeup of the commission that I mentioned, Florida Power and Light, the largest utility in the state, asked the commission for over $500 million in a rate hike over several years. The commission began considering the case, but then Florida Power and Light, the utility, reached a settlement with three consumers. They were organizational consumers, not average people. And the Office of Public Counsel was not involved with that settlement. So Public Counsel J.R. Kelly sued, saying that he should have had more of a seat at the table. Now, the case is still before the Supreme Court. The justices have yet to rule, but there are basically two sides. On the Public Service Commission side, the main lawyer is General Counsel Kaiser, from whom we heard earlier. He says, hey, the commission did review the case. It just reviewed the settlement as well.
The Office of Public Counsel wanted the regular rate hearing process to go forward and not take the settlement up. We did both. We took up first the rate case and handled that just like we normally would, with all of the same protections and everybody being heard and arguments and witnesses and documents being submitted to the commission.
And then he said, after months of review of both that case and the settlement, the commission decided to base its decision on the settlement, and it allowed the utilities to raise rates by $350 million over several years. Now, here's Kelly's perspective on the same matter.
We believe that the settlement that the Public Service Commission approved between Florida Power and Light and three of the interveners, and those were the Florida Industrial Power Users Group, the Florida Executive Agencies, which are the military bases, and a South Florida Hospital Association. We believe that that settlement is a nullity.
The reason he says that his organization should have been involved is that's his interpretation of a state statute that says that the Office of Public Counsel represents average consumers and that average consumers weren't at the table. He says the utility company basically worked out a deal with organizational consumers. So where was the voice for the average person?
So the two sides of this case obviously don't see eye to eye. I mean, what's at stake in this case? Is a single rate hike vote really worth a trip to the state Supreme Court?
Kelly argues judicial precedent is on the line. The statutes and laws giving the Office of Public Counsel a seat at the table aren't quite clear. In fact, during oral arguments on the case, the Supreme Court justices kept asking for clarification on those statutes, and neither side seemed to be able to give it. Kelly says if he wins this case, the power of his office could be clarified and solidified through judicial law, judicial interpretation. But if he loses, he says this.
If this settlement is allowed to stand, and a utility comes in and files a rate case, they could go out and get several business groups to intervene in the case. And certainly we would intervene. They could go cut a deal with the other interveners, give them some price concessions, stick it to all the other remaining ratepayers, and never even come talk to us because they don't have to.
Kaiser says this case is not about judicial precedent. He says the ruling will just determine if the parties have to go back to the negotiating table. I pressed him on that question, saying, aren't all Supreme Court cases about judicial precedent? Here's what he said.
No, because the real issue in the Supreme Court case that the public counsel is arguing, you know, is that a certain amount of due process was not handled. And so, you know, if the court rules in the favor of the commission, they're simply saying, no, the commission did have enough due process, the case was properly handled, and therefore their decision is upheld.
So when you started looking into Florida utilities, Amy, you looked at some laws and not regulations or regulators, but how are lawmakers not involved in regulation actually moving forward on these matters?
They're not moving much at all, really. Both Kelly and Kaiser say their organizations will follow whatever laws legislators pass. Over the years, lawmakers have proposed bills to try to separate or further separate utilities and regulators. Those bills rarely get more than a single conversation at a committee level. They're basically dead on arrival. That said, some lawmakers have talked about getting rid of Public Counsel Kelly and moving his office under the governor, like the commission is now. That talk hasn't gone anywhere either. But all this said, one could argue that Floridians in some way support the current method of utility regulation in Florida because they vote and they elect the politicians who appoint utility regulators. So maybe Floridians groan when their electric bills rise, but those same Floridians elect lawmakers who appoint and confirm regulators who authorize the rate hikes. So at the end of the day, that's the voice of democracy.
Well, thank you very much for trying to untangle some of the ins and outs of utility regulation in Florida, Amy. And thanks for joining us on Intersection.
Thank you.
That's 90.7 reporter and All Things Considered host Amy Kiley talking to us about Florida's utility regulation policies. The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Brendan Byrne is assistant producer. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.